Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
But thank you very much for coming. My name is Brady. Use that name anytime you like. And because you had that excellent lunch and you're all ready for a little nap, what we're going to do today is jump right into results and put a few numbers, the results that were obtained, on the screen in front of you. Anyone care to venture what these numbers mean?
Gallon of gasoline across the country.
No, not all of them. Some of that's ancient history on there. So, what these are is, yes, ma'am?
Fee increases?
No, not fee increases. These are savings. Savings in dollars per square foot per year attained by institutions with the technology that we're going to talk about today. I have higher numbers. I don't put those up because there's little quirks in those projects. I have lower numbers. We'll talk about a number of different applications, but take a careful look. $3.72 per square foot per year in savings attained. And we'll show you the return on investment and those type of things as well. The topic in question and where those savings are coming from are from the means that the facility is ventilated. Every building needs some ventilation. At least every building has people in it. And most of in this room are dealing with buildings that have people in them. Happens everywhere, and oftentimes we kind of take it for granted. How much ventilation do they have? The amount of ventilation is established at design based on parameters given to the architects and engineers by those who need this building built, and it is an expected maximum capacity, or close to maximum capacity. That's the amount that is put into the building. And we all sit around in buildings all the times in our daily lives, both during work, after hours. We're dealing with buildings, and we don't think about ventilation very much. And it doesn't get much attention in the building management quite often. The fact is, it is a continuous cost. Any mechanical engineering students, practitioners, designers, licensed people in the audience? All right, you can put your hands down so not everybody knows who the other one is. So, on an annual basis, how much does one CFM of fresh air supplied to a building cost? Actually, I said to mechanical engineers, anybody's willing to venture a guess. But this is a little bit mechanical engineering speak. 3, 2, 1. Same response we always get from the engineering community. They don't know. They didn't think about it. We take this for granted. Every building by code is required to have fresh air drawn into it, depending on the processes and the contents and the people. That varies, so we are supplying many thousands of CFM to buildings. I did speak with someone that was the director of a campus in the Midwest who said his utility cost to supply one CFM of fresh air per year was $2.60-some-odd. He said, when I add in the life cycle cost of providing the equipment to move and condition that air and maintain that equipment, it's probably in the range of $5 to $6. The number varies all over the map. Depends on the climate, the location, the cost of utilities, the processes, the building application, all those type of things. But using that, let's say, $3 to $5 per year, if we're supplying 10,000 CFM of air to a building, that's $30,000 to $50,000. And we never think of it in that context. What we're talking about today is doing that, taking a more careful look at where that ventilation really draws on resources, the utility bills, and that type of thing. We approach this in three tiers, and I will present them in order of the low-hanging fruit down to where there's some stretch to get the best benefits out of it. The first place to look at ventilation is where there is a tremendous demand for 100% fresh air. That place would be a laboratory building, animal research, research facilities, any place where air is drawn in to dilute what's going on in the space and eliminate anything that's being generated in that space. Tremendous opportunity for savings. Next area with good potential has to do with a high variation in the number of occupants in the building. Think about the Performing Arts Center. Think about auditoriums, lecture halls, the 150-seat lecture halls. Some days they're full. Some days they're not. If it's freshman chemistry, it's packed. They're sitting on top of each other. But when it became the only room available to senior chemistry, that 150-seat room may only have 30 people in it. And then what I refer to as the day-to-day building, the office building, the elementary schoolhouse, all those type of buildings, which don't seem to be big consumers of energy and that type of thing, all of them are demanding ventilation, the regular classroom building. Each one of these presents an opportunity, not just in energy savings, but of all of the other things that we're talking about here at this conference, making the building more sustainable, better to the community, etc. A case study. Again, since we're all here right after lunch, full and ready for a nap, I'm going to go straight to the results. What you're looking at is data from a campus monitoring system. This data is actually showing heating hot water from the central plant being supplied to the building. The little brown cloud in the middle is the point where our technology was put online. On the left is the heating use in the summer months. On the right is the heating use in the winter months. Interesting that we've reduced the heating below the summer for the winter. Well, that's because we've taken this approach to addressing how the building is truly ventilated. Some of you may have seen this slide yesterday if you attended a presentation given by Mike Lurch from Cal State Monterey Bay. They had a science building there, teaching science, a lot of different types of science going on in the building that was designed to have 10 air changes per hour supplied to it continuously, 24 hours, 7 days a week. Obviously, they don't have classes in there 24 hours, 7 days a week. And we went in and addressed that problem by making the ventilation to be provided on demand to what was happening in the classrooms. And not just with people in the classrooms, but with activities, chemical processes, and that type of things. When those processes weren't there, we can reduce the ventilation, and when they are there, we do increase it. The IOU partnership was very much an active participant in this project. So a lot of different numbers. These numbers are a little different than Mike's yesterday because he had a couple other projects, and his presentation, he kind of lumped them together. But for about $105,000 investment, he got $67,000 a year in savings out of it. He had several projects going on together. The utility provided $95,000. An incentive to complete this project. Those utility numbers, excuse me, the energy numbers that you just saw, that graph, was estimated up front, and that estimate was verified to make sure that the project could go forward, and then afterwards, a third party came in and verified that the savings were achieved. That's part of the process. The utility doesn't want to invest money in a bad deal. They want to know it looked good up front, and they want to know what happened at the end, and it did. The bottom line, it's a number that you saw before, $3.72 per square foot per year is what they saved out of this project. But does that mean if you have a 1 million square foot campus, you're going to get $3 million a year in return? No, this doesn't apply to all buildings. This was science education. But they got $67,000 in savings at a year ago rates from 18,000 square feet. Very attractive return on investment. So how is this done? Let's talk a little bit about what goes on in educational buildings. This will be very rudimentary to some of you and might be brand new to others. So I apologize, I'll try to cover everything. The basic principle of a high ventilation building, especially these lab and science buildings, is that air is introduced into the space to cover a number of factors. One is the hood load, one is the thermal load, and one is the dilution load. The dilution load is quite often, dilution ventilation is normally a very high component. How much air does a lab need? Mechanical engineers, anybody want to state your opinion? And they just smile. Okay. There is a lot of different opinions on that. It depends on what's going on in the lab. The purpose of the dilution is to take care of things that happen outside the hood. When there's a fume hood in the lab, we don't have anything to do with that. It continues to do what it's supposed to do, and it draws ventilation from the room, takes anything that's in that hood away from the researcher, scientist, or student, and evacuates it from the building. The purpose of the dilution ventilation is when the students are working on the bench. The researcher is working on the bench. They are working with an instrument that won't fit in the hood or something to that effect. And it's a very large demand. So if we look at this in graphic perspective, the hoods need some air. The thermal load needs some air. And the dilution typically needs the most air. Do we need the dilution air? Take a look at some real data from a California institution. The answer is yes, absolutely. What you're looking at on the screen is data taken from a laboratory showing volatile organic compounds being released into the air within that lab over a period of about a month and a half. In fact, it's not a single lab. There are about 20. There's a list of them on the right. You don't have to try and read them. But if you look at the fact that you're looking at a month and a half worth of data, every one of these little spikes, even the tiny ones, represent a need for a large amount of air to clean some agent from the lab that has been introduced there by the processes going on. But here's the point. If we go back and look at our picture, that green air was designed into the building to take care of those spikes. The spikes, on average, last less than 15 minutes. The spikes never happen in the same lab at the same time. Never say never. But I actually analyzed this data myself, and there were no instances of full demand ventilation being needed at exactly the same time in two different labs. Yes, you need it every day, all the time, in this lab, that lab, several others. But what happens for the most part is that people do something, they make their plume or whatever it is, they do their preparation out on the bench, ventilation is increased, that agent is cleared from the room, and then it slows back down using the technology that we're talking about. But the traditional design principle is, let's just blow a lot of air through there. The technology that we are applying to buildings takes that big green box and makes it variable like the other two elements of the ventilation in the laboratory, and it does so in response to the things such as the contaminants in the air, volatile organic compounds, carbon dioxide, particulate levels. Occasionally we'll get into carbon monoxide, although usually that's a different application that's outside. We're looking at the quality of the air in the building, not just the temperature of it. Another case study, the Biodesign Institute. This puts into perspective the aggregate effect when we start applying this across multiple zones. Biodesign Institute was Lab of the Year when it came online. Beautiful facility. Envy of the research world that it was chosen to be where it is, and that happens to be in the middle of the Sonoran Desert over in Arizona. Beautiful building, beautiful processes, great research, and complete flabbergast when they turned it on and saw what happened to the utility cost. If you look at this graph at the top left, you'll see where things started. This is data taken from a pilot study that they did applying the AirQuity technology to 11 zones. Those 11 zones were consuming about 15, 16,000 CFM as an aggregate between all of them. You see a significant drop there. That occurs at the start of the Arizona summer. And what we did was applied a means to measure the demand for ventilation through those labs and raise it up to the level required, maximum of design needed, but only when needed. This graph of data goes from the start of the summer all the way through the end of the year. Never did they have to go back to that 16,000 CFM. But various times, regularly during the year, they did have to take one specific lab or two specific labs up to design levels to clear some agent in that lab. At the far left is all labs running together with ventilation just in case. Once the system came online, then the ventilation was done in response to actual conditions in the laboratory. Yes, ma'am.
Is everything automatic,
like
is there a sensor?
There is. I'm going to tell you about that. Yes. So, and it is very automatic. So, no one's sitting there 24 hours a day. So the premise is to manage the ventilation according to the total indoor environmental quality, not just a traditional thermal approach or temperature and humidity approach. So what determines the quality of the air within a building? Well, from a comfort perspective, yes, we've dealt with temperature and humidity for years. Carbon dioxide is sometimes described as a comfort issue, because if all of us in here breathe enough and not enough ventilation, we can all go to sleep and be comfortable. So sometimes it is shown up as a contaminant issue. There are particulates that are generated in the space. There are volatile organic compounds, especially in these science buildings. That's typically what people are working with. Anything that has an aroma or smell or stink to it is probably a VOC. If there are animal research processes involved, well, animals bring a lot of aromas and agents of their own, including particulates. Acidic reactions bring particulates. Lots of things to look at as we address indoor environmental quality. So understanding what is going on in the air and what to do with ventilation becomes a little bit more sophisticated. But it's very simple. The young lady asked about sensors, and one approach would be to put sensors all over the wall. Now, since our mechanical engineers identified themselves, anyone here from the maintenance department of an institution? Probably, I guess not, because typically when the picture gets this far, they say, please don't. Because they have to take care of all of this. If we are going to go this step of looking at what's in the air, we are dealing with instruments that do require some attention. We're going to add more wire, we're going to add more complexity to the system, and for the most part, we are going to make the maintenance man lose his mind. Not only do we have a lot of instruments to maintain and a process for each one, they're located in spaces that aren't always accessible and that type of thing. AirQuity was formed by a gentleman that had an idea based on years of working in the lab space of a way to look at what was in the air, measure what was there, and control the ventilation accordingly. We sense total volatile organic compounds, the things that smell, the things that are generated from solvents and that type of thing. Carbon dioxide, carbon monoxide, moisture. We actually, in our most precise applications, use a non-dispersive infrared hygrometer. Fancy word to say that we're looking at the air for parts per million of actual water molecules. We measure particulate levels, very small particles, in the range of what is referred to as M2.5, or 2.5 micron particles, quite commonly generated in labs and another number of other applications. Instead of putting those sensors all over the wall, which becomes a little bit challenging, if not to maintain, but to keep working, we do it in a very reliable fashion that is much easier to apply than that approach, and it is easy to maintain. The principle of the OptiNet system, instead of all those sensors, is that we sample a packet. We take a packet of air out of the space to be monitored, and we send that to a very good set of laboratory-grade instruments that are located out of the space in an equipment closet somewhere that's convenient to the building staff and that type of thing. That allows us to use a much higher-grade sensor because we're not spending so much time and money putting them everywhere. We use the laboratory-grade instruments. Many of these analyses of the quality of the air and the environment within a building is done in reference to the quality of the air outside the building. And they are very precise, and what we're really interested in is the differential. That differential has to be precise, and since we're using a single instrument to measure both places, because we're sampling the outside air and we're sampling the inside air, we have no error in our differential measurement. Much easier to maintain, and we'll come back to that in a moment. But there's the principle. You're looking at a floor plan, and if you look over here and find my magic pointer, you'll notice that we take a sample of air, run it through a special network, back to a very good set of laboratory-grade instruments, and establish what's in that. And we keep moving around sequentially, continuously, to all the spaces of concern within the facility. This was a lab space. We would move one lab, next lab, next lab. Typically, designing the system so that we will analyze the air in any space at least 4 times an hour. We run around, we determine what is going on with the air, and then we send a signal to the ventilation system or the system controlling the ventilation, and we will tell that system, here's the conditions as we see it. Now, it has other priorities in life. It may be involved with smoke control. It may be involved with a situation that has more demand because of thermal purposes. It takes our input as one of many and makes the final decision. And that's the architecture of the system there. All these little gray boxes are places where the samples are taken. There's a very important component of this network and enabling technology that made this possible, and that is something called the microduct. To take a sample from one place and move it to another and be able to analyze it, we have to know that it stays intact. Everything that was in it in that room is still there. And we have to make sure that nothing sticks to the walls of a tube as we go through. Pardon me, a conventional plastic tube would not work because they develop static charge. Conventional plastic would not work because it would absorb these volatile organics that we're looking for. Option would be to use stainless steel tubing, very prohibitive to work with. So we developed a special component that is an application of carbon technology, carbon nanotechnology, not carbon emissions, carbon nanotechnology, where we have a plastic material that is electrically conductive and is completely inert so it doesn't absorb anything. Very enabling technology that lets this possible. But the bottom line is we are taking air out of a space, bringing it back to a very good set of laboratory instruments, making a decision on where the ventilation should be and directing that system accordingly. So, now, that allows us to get some energy savings. And you saw the numbers. In the laboratories, it's very high. Runs, I've seen as high as $6 and $7 a square foot, but as I mentioned, those are anomalies, special applications where they were really going hog wild with what they were doing with their ventilation. In the case of animal research facilities, though, there's some tremendous potential there. A lot of discussion, a lot of opinion about how much air those animals need. Those very expensive laboratory mice and all the other types of animals do get a tremendous amount of air. And there's lots of discussion going on as to whether or not they really need it. But there's another way to pull data or pull money out of thin air. That's through a concept called diversity. I bring up a case study of a project called the Green Lab. This building has not been built, and as far as I know, it never will. It was planned to be built, but it was a very detailed study in how to build a green lab building. Basic facts, about 150,000 square feet, plus 25,000 optional vivarium. They looked at everything to make it green, 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 as green as possible. And They looked at the traditional approach, a certain quantity of air on a fixed basis, applied air acuity. In the non-animal spaces, instead of a fixed 9 air changes, they went from a base of 4 to 16. When we detected something in the air, if the concentration was strong enough, we would provide 16 air changes an hour, which very much satisfied the environmental health and safety people, and those folks said, great, we can get lots of air when we need it. In the animal spaces, similar range, instead of 15 air changes, again, we're running up to the 16 air changes, a little bit more, and providing variability when the air around those animals is very clean. So they saved roughly $250,000 a year in energy savings from that perspective. But a significant aspect of first cost savings came by looking at the fact that none of these, or not all of these labs, would need all of this air at the same time. They were able to reduce the first cost of the project by about $1 million, which more than paid for the cost of the air acuity technology. Back to our graph from before. Again, what we're talking about is the fact that not every one of those labs needs all of that air at the same time. So why do we need to have an air handling system on top of the building that is doing or capable of sizing just that? So, anybody here from the University of California, Irvine? There you go. Your stem cell research project has it. So, a 40% reduction in the primary side of the air handling system has provided enough first cost savings to offset the cost of applying the air acuity technology. Now, the annual savings, the operating savings, will come later on. Now, different type of application is the variable occupancy. Again, think about those places where there is some days when you've got lots of people, some days when you don't. All the students in the room know what it's like in some of your classrooms. Some of them are packed, some of them are not. Performing arts, I always say that's a great example. The Performing Arts Center is designed to hold 5,000, 7,000, 2,000, whatever the number is. When the great performance is there, it's packed, standing room only. And you have a ventilation system intended to supply those 7,000 people with good, fresh air. How many people are there for dress rehearsal? Even if friends, brothers, relatives, moms, and dads come in and sit, because that's the only chance they'll get to see the play, you still only have 200 people in the building. And the facility is designed for 7,000. Should you ventilate it accordingly? No. And in this principle, we're taking those types of facilities and looking at the quality of the air to determine what the real load on the ventilation system is. I apologize. I dug around for some data from a university classroom or lecture hall example, and I didn't find a good set of data. This is close. Same type of application where you've got a bunch of people coming into a bunch of big rooms at one time. Happens to be the county courthouse. And you can see that some of the courtrooms, this one for example, that's about 10:30 in the morning, heated discussions going on. Could be a crowd of people. Lots of CO2 being generated. And what happens? Right about here, the attorneys are at lunch. There's the rest of the day. They solve the problem over lunch, I presume. So, this similar situation, not quite as heated, whatever the case may be, not as many people. They did not solve the problem over lunch. They're back and they have high concentrations. And it backed off, came back on, etc. This orange line, probably never occupied because the purple line is the outside air level of carbon dioxide in this neighborhood. Should we ventilate this room, be it lecture hall, courtroom, or whatever, at the same level as this one? No. That one should get the air when it needs it. This one does not. And that avoids the conditioning, the movement of that air. Think about the sports arena. Some days, it's the championship game. Some days, it's the championship team practicing. This happens to be a case from a commercial arena where the NHL plays on some nights, and that's the first group of spikes there, NHL hockey game. Any hockey fans? Oh, well, Dan, I can pick on hockey fans then, since you're the only one. So we all know how excited they go. In fact, they probably still haven't cooled off what happened just recently. We had a final. So very big crowd, full house, lots of activity. These are carbon dioxide levels. If you look at the volatile organic compounds, a lot of things there from the people, from the popcorn. Very full demand on ventilation at that point. Happens to be one day later, this hall was rented to a concert. Not the big U2 or something like that. Something that only took about half the facility. And look at the demand on the ventilation. It's about half. And then the next night, the arena has a lease with the local professional indoor soccer team. It's a great sport, but it doesn't draw a crowd. That's why ESPN doesn't show you the stands, because they're empty during the indoor soccer game. Should we ventilate indoor soccer at the same level as we do the NHL? Think about your own arenas where you have a large crowd and it can vary from time to time. I talked to one institution, not in California, farther east, said they've been in there watching the system running full tilt while there's some boys in there shooting hoops, boys or girls, whatever the case may be. Just shooting some hoops, but they had the ventilation system on and running. No reason, especially when it's either hot or cold. I know, Santa Barbara, you folks don't know what that means, but there are places, some of the institutions represented get out in the valley, nice hot summer days, where you want the minimum amount of ventilation put in to satisfy the load, not just design conditions which may or may not be there. So think variable occupancy as another place where savings can be attained. Any thoughts on what California Title 24 says about this? Another typical response. Believe it or not, it's a mandate in high-density occupancy facilities. It states that if you have a building designed to have 25 people per 1,000 square feet, which is this type, theater-type seating, pretty dense occupancy, that you are supposed to have demand control ventilation. Interesting, the amount of times that I ask that question where people are still becoming aware of the fact that Title 24 is looking at the DCV side of building ventilation. Title 24 also recommends looking at DCV for other applications as well. Doesn't mandate it, but it does recommend looking at it. And it does tie into the next tier of occupancy that I mentioned, and that's the conventional building. Demand control ventilation for the average office building, whatever the case may be, what I call conventional, is being addressed in all kinds of different initiatives. ASHRAE is looking at it. LEED talks about it. LEED talks about it from the perspective of the things that are in buildings. If we think about a standard office building, designer sits down and puts together a design that will produce this level of air. Certain level of occupancy, that's how much air you're going to need, and that's the design level. And so we turn on the air handlers in the morning, and we get a little bit of extra because not everybody's there right when we turn them on. And in theory, about half an hour after the building's supposed to be occupied, they're all there. Theory never happens. What we typically see is a profile like this. Some days, a lot of people come to work. Some days, some types of facilities, people come to work, people go. It's very interesting to compare the courthouse that we looked at to the district attorney's office. Courthouse is very empty, especially at the start of the morning. Trials don't start until 9 or 10. And then people do show up. The district attorney's office is very busy from 7 to 9. Then all the attorneys and their staff head for the courtrooms, and they get empty. So there's a transition. We get a lot of nice days, people go out for lunch. variation in the demand of based on the amount of people in the building. Anybody know what day that is? Friday before the three-day weekend. Half the folks show up. Planned, of course. They all said, we're going to make it a four-day weekend. But we see that all the time. Should we ventilate to that design level that we had before? Or respond accordingly and ventilate to what's in the building? I will grant you that especially here in this western climate, in California, the climate that we're all famous for, it is more of a stretch to do this, but all of these initiatives keep encouraging us to take the stretch and apply something that will get that extra energy out of these applications. The applications are the basic demand controlled ventilation, comparing enthalpy, which is total heat content, to the outside air to what's inside the building, looking in certain locations for the air outside the building being undesirable. We have a project we brought online last year out in the middle of Wyoming where the air you would perceive to be as fresh as it could ever be. Breezy, sometimes a little dusty, but it just so happens in that location there where they do get a good amount of breeze, the loading dock is on the upwind side of the building. How could that be? We close the dampers when conditions are such that we're sensing high CO2 levels in the outside air. There's a number of applications where moisture content is of concern. Healthcare, there's been discussion about chilled beams here. There's a number of applications where the particulates being admitted into the space are of grave concern, so we verify filtration. A number of ways that this technology can improve the overall operation of the building and quite often save some energy as well. I mentioned the LEED standard. For those of you new to the term LEED, it stands for Leadership in Energy Efficiency and Design. And it is a guideline established by the United States Green Building Council, which is a large group of people gathering together to make buildings more sustainable. The LEED guideline addresses indoor environmental quality in a number of different locations. With respect to the quality itself, it talks about quality of air during construction, right after construction, and ongoing. As you saw, we have the potential to save tremendous amounts of energy. There is an opportunity to gain LEED points from the energy portion, the energy and atmosphere portion of the LEED standard. There is potential for innovation in design. So this ties very much into the LEED standard as well. Effectively managing ventilation can very much help gain some LEED points for those of you working on LEED standard buildings. There's a number of users already applying this technology. I mentioned a couple institutions here in California. The folks from Irvine have already have one system up and running, another one coming online. The Cal State system has systems up and running. You saw Mike's there. The community college system is off and running about, well, actually, no, their first job has already started, none online yet, but they have a very large set of campuses, and our representative here, the Yardley Company, is running around like crazy trying to keep up with the community colleges. What would you think would be in a community college? They have a lot of those vocational labs, which demand tremendous amounts of air, and there's tremendous potential for savings. I would expect that somehow, at some point, when you add all those campuses together, it's going to be a significant figure that someone will take notice of. So in summary, that ventilation that we don't think about much represents a lot of money. It's thin air that you can pull out of it's money that you can pull out of the thin air in a number of different types of facilities. In many cases, given circumstances such as diversity, high ventilation rates, we've seen it where the system is basically free. The IOU partnership is very much aware of this and is contributing incentives on a number of projects to get this applied because the savings are substantial. So we hope you will give it consideration at your institutions, and our anxious to help in any way we can. And given that, I'll open it up to any questions, any discussion that you have. Yes, ma'am.
The IOU was willing to partner.
Yes. The investor-owned utility partnership is all of the investor-owned utilities in California, Sempra, San Diego Gas and Electric, Southern Cal Edison, PG&E, a few other members of the partnership there, who are supplying energy to this state predominantly and have the ability to provide funding to someone doing an energy incentive or an energy type retrofit in exchange for them having to build other power plants. That's the basic premise. If we continue to increase our consumption of gas and electricity, they've got to continue to increase their ability to supply it. For every opportunity that we take to reduce the energy, they will help fund that, given that they see the proper parameters.
No.
The analysis, I would recommend it, not so much for their needs, but for other applications with respect to monitoring the projects. I'm sure at one of these conferences you've heard a presentation about sub-metering of the buildings, but you don't need that to gain the incentive. What is required is an application form, and there are some preliminary calculations done. With respect to this offering, we do help with those calculations. We don't say that, give the final word. We show them all the parameters. We show them the how we come up with our estimates, and then we turn it over to them. In fact, most of the utilities turn it over. Anyone from the IOU in the room? So we turn those numbers over to them. They send them out to a third party that really verifies that the savings are achievable, and then they come back after the project has been running for a while and verify that they were achieved. Then the money is handed over. Yes? We don't touch them at all. They're independent. They continue to do what they have to do. If you look at the total picture in the laboratory, there is a ventilation controller that maintains a certain balance of air to the surrounding area. We become another input to that controller. When someone opens a hood, indicating that there's more air needed, that air goes into that hood, and that ventilation controller brings more air in from the supply. When we say that there has been some agent released into the space and more air is needed to get rid of it, we tell the ventilation controller, and it takes it all in balance. Yes?
So when you say some agent, there's a fairly large complexity of chemicals that might be present in the lab at any given time. What's your range and what's your methodology for sampling the air? What are you looking for specifically? And
we're looking for volatile organics. We're looking for particulate levels. We are measuring by photoionization. For volatile organics, we are measuring for metal oxide through using a metal oxide technology for volatile organics. We are measuring using non-dispersive infrared for carbon dioxide. Particulates, we use a laser scatter principle. And as I said, carbon monoxide we don't look for very often unless it is specifically associated with a process. Occasionally, there is something in a lab. We do sense carbon monoxide, but it's typically more found where there's vehicles and that type of things involved. So,
have you had the conversation about what toxic chemicals might be present that would be?
We have. We always include in the discussion that we are not an emergency response system. We are managing the chemicals that are supposed to be out in the lab space anyway. If there's something that's supposed to be in a glove box and it accidentally got out, well, that person probably got exposed anyway. So, yeah. So, yes, we are energy conservation, not emergency response. I would love to, since we're almost out of time, continue that discussion offline because there are some safety benefits. And bear with me, I'll dig in a little bit here. But if you consider the volatile compounds, traditionally, with that high volume of air, the vaporization is faster because you got more air flowing across the agent. We've seen a number of results from laboratory tests where when you slow things down, so we're sitting there and somebody gets out on the bench, the generation is much slower. Eventually, we will detect it. It will reach us. And then you'll see the air come up. And I've got data on my laptop. I can show you actual tests where this happens. So, but again, it's energy management for the stuff that they're allowed to have on the bench. And some of that stuff does have exposure levels that's pretty high in the 15-minute range. So we're saying, great, we detected it. Let's get some air in here, get rid of it. It's gone. Now let's save energy. Make sense? Okay. Yes. I have not. We have had a lot of discussion about it. As soon as you talk about that natural ventilation and operable windows and that sort of thing, it becomes kind of a research application. What town are you in? And the nature of allowing the windows to be open and that type of thing. So we certainly would not see that in a laboratory environment. We certainly look at what is happening in outside air. A lot of our users will look and see. In fact, I was on looking, comparing cities across the country at 4 o'clock in the morning to see what this true level is. People look at what's going on in the outside air, but in terms of the natural ventilation, no. Not that I'm aware of yet that we actually have that on a project. Be handy to have to see what is happening with respect to the outside air quality coming into the building, good or bad. Next question.
One right here. Hi. I believe I heard that Cal State Monterey Bay is going to a minimum of 4 air changes per hour occupied and 2 air changes per hour unoccupied.
Yes.
Is it true that OSHA hasn't yet approved 2 air changes per hour, and are you anticipating that happening?
OSHA does not care about unoccupied labs. And that was told to me by the lady from OSHA, because they are the Occupied Health and Safety Act, not the Unoccupied Health and Safety Act. And what is actually happening at Monterey Bay and a number of other institutions, we monitor occupancy with a motion detector. Anytime somebody comes into the lab, we will go to 4 air changes an hour, even if the air is perfectly clean. Not that it's necessary. The other thing is, OSHA is a guideline. It's not a building code or anything to that effect. None of the building codes really say 4 air changes. ASHRAE 62 talks about CFM per square foot and that type of thing. So the 4 air changes in some cases, and this gentleman said 4 air changes was perfectly acceptable. He's got peers in his role that are saying, we'll just go to 2. And when you tell me there's some bad stuff in the air, we'll go ahead and raise up and go as high as we need to go. So there's nothing that prevents a lab from going all the way down to 2. There are people that have opinion different to his that say, because of some of the more hazardous things I'm working with, I'm not going to go below 8. So, but in the case of that building, it is science teaching facility. They're not dealing with extremely hazardous things. They're dealing with acetones and alcohols and those type of agents that it's perfectly acceptable to run along at 4. Anytime somebody's in there, when we sense something, then we'll raise it up. And I have data tests from their facility that I can show you the whole picture. Unoccupied clean air, unoccupied dirty air, that somebody left something bubbling, and occupied clean air, and show it all coming up and down. Not on this computer, though. It's on a different one. But okay. I'll be happy to show you later. Yes?
I have one more question, if you don't mind. You said you were going to talk more about maintenance.
Yes.
Annual maintenance costs, what does it take?
The principle there, and I'm not going to click my button 26 times to get back to a slide. As I mentioned, we have a very small quantity of instruments. Typically, we will have one instrument for every 20 or so zones in a laboratory environment. So instead of having to go to 20 labs and calibrate a VOC sensor, a CO2 sensor, a moisture sensor, our program calls for going to that central spot where the instruments are located and exchanging what's in place with some that are calibrated freshly in a calibration depot. Not only are they calibrated, they're refurbished, they're cleaned. It's a NIST traceable environment. So our beyond recommendation, almost insistence, is that every 6 months these be exchanged. That says that the system is then never more than 6 months from brand new. The program includes replacement of degraded elements, because some of these technologies, I mentioned laser scatter, I mentioned metal oxide, it's a way to detect certain agents in the air, but those instruments have a very finite life. What is it? It's not 22 and a half months. It might be 15 months, it might be 30 months, it might be something. But we know it's going to die. When we see that happening, we throw that degrading instrument away, we put in a brand new one, and that is covered in the cost of the service. The owner doesn't get an extra bill for a new instrument every time the system gets refurbished and upgraded. The person doing the work does not have to visit each lab, classroom, whatever the case may be. Even something like the K-12 schoolhouse, where you think, well, that's not a critical environment. It is critical to disrupt a bunch of third graders. If they're listening to the teacher, which says the person would have to work afternoons and evenings to go through every classroom. Calibrating, I use that example of 20 labs, takes about 45 minutes to do all 20 of them. Not 45 minutes per. Calibrating a lab with four instruments in it probably takes 2 hours at least per lab. So a tremendous return on investment in that regard, too.
I've got a question. I came in a little late. I apologize. You may have already addressed this, so if you need to address it quickly, go for it. How effective is your technology on existing older buildings, retrofits, versus doing it in new construction?
Very effective. And we have done buildings that are antique, still in pneumatic control days. We have a number of different ways to interface to an older system. It's not a complex installation to apply our system. Now, we do run into older buildings that the mechanical side prevents more of a challenge. If the building is 100% constant volume laboratory, well, you're not going to vary ventilation just by hooking up to it because there's nothing to turn up and down. But talking about some of the examples here, the Monterey Bay project was, help me, Matt, is he here? Less than 10 years old, built since 2000. One of the UCI installations, 95, I believe, was when that building was built. 2002. So I mentioned the Biodesign Institute. It's located adjacent to Arizona State University. We have projects of all ages there. Some of those projects, I talk about costs of $100,000 to put our systems in. Some of those projects are multi-million projects being done by an energy service contractor, and we're a small piece of it because they're going in, they're pulling out the air handlers, they're putting in VAV, they're putting in new chiller and that type of thing. So, but we the only thing different on a retrofit project is we just got to look at how old it is and what's there to be worked with. Yes. Yes, ma'am. While you're completing your survey, you can write down the notes on how to get in touch with us. The George Yardley Company is our representative in California throughout the state, and they're located in Santa Ana. So remember Yardley, remember AirCuity, and Google will find either one of us because Google knows everything.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.